Waiter, will you serve the nuts? I mean, will you serve the guests the nuts?
TGIF, it's Manson Mitchell with Gary Manson, Suzanne Mitchell. A double shot of good conversation with great guests to jumpstart your weekend. Manson Mitchell, you're on the air.
Thank you, Eric Kramer. I think we're all a little nuts, especially on Friday, kicking off our weekend and hopefully yours as well, ladies and gentlemen. Glad to have you with us. I'm Gary Manson.
I'm Suzanne Mitchell.
Together we are Manson Mitchell in your ears for the hour, and we are fortunate once again to be working alongside, diagonally across the continent,
3,000 miles plus,
with bad boy Benny Mathers at the board, our producer. Benny, how are you today, sir?
Doing much better than last week. I kind of figured you're going with something with the whole nuts intro, but not because we're crazy. It's only because a certain procedure I might have had last Friday. That's what I thought you were going with. Yep.
We didn't know.
Well, Nathan was nice. He didn't say anything about it, because then I'd get on him about it. But no, everything's good. Got the P's on the B's, and we're good to go.
Excellent.
I like Gary's reaction right there.
I tell you, I've often said if I were a physician that performed that particular procedure, my marketing special would be 20% off the bill and 2 tickets to the Nutcracker. Drive that traffic into my door. Absolutely.
We did not know, Benny.
That's fine. It's totally fine. I just was like, wow, that's convenient. The week after. I'm like,
yeah, that was fair.
Let me ask you, Benny, is it relatively painless?
For the first couple of days, it's just being uncomfortable. That's about it. I mean, I went to a Rainiers game the very next day and just kind of sat there and just relaxed and had a good time. Yeah, it was pretty good, actually. Not going to, like, wasn't jumping for joy or, like, you know what I mean? Like, all right. But, you know, yeah. Haven't done it before either, so I can't compare it to, you know. If you had a comparison.
A unique experience, yes.
Right. But,
once
yeah.
is plenty.
Pretty much.
Very well. And we're always glad to be working with you, Benny. You're
Me
a great
too.
Producer.
Welcome.
Today, we get to have another visit with our friend, Jeffrey Mark. What an extraordinary gentleman. Why don't you go ahead and give him his mad props? Now, today, we're going to be talking about Broadway to Hollywood, successful transitions from the stage to the silver screen. This is going to be fun.
Jeffrey Mark has been called a walking encyclopedia of show business history, a singer, stand-up comedian in nightclubs and cabarets, and an off-Broadway veteran. Jeffrey has hosted radio series, written comedy, and now writes and produces documentaries and reality shows for cable television. He has also written 3 best-selling books devoted to Lucille Ball, Ella Fitzgerald, and Ethel Merman, and has a brand new podcast, which we will talk about at the bottom of the hour break so that you can hear more and interact more with Jeffrey Mark. In the meantime, we are welcoming you once again to Manson Mitchell. Jeffrey, good to have you with us.
Happy to be here. I'm excited to talk about that guy you just introduced. He sounds wonderful.
Oh, he's a great guy. You have lived in both places. You are a New Yorker who now lives in California. And Gary and I were just thinking about that coast-to-coast connection, going from the East Coast to the West Coast, having things start in New York as plays on Broadway. You have been off Broadway. And then all of a sudden, California picks it up and makes a movie out of it. And we thought, how fascinating. I wonder how many there have been. Well, I went online and I found too many movies to name that actually started as plays in New York. My hand got tired of writing when I got to about the 100th film. And so we thought this will be a great topic for you, having been off Broadway and knowing New York as well as you do, and Hollywood as well as you do. So we're really happy to talk to you about this today.
Well, you know, it starts all the way back to silent films. There were silent films that were plays on Broadway that they chose because they were easy to visualize. You didn't need to hear the person's voice as long as you could have really well-written title cards. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, a title card was an actor on the film would mouth something, never in English, because they wanted to use the same piece of film all over the world. So they would mouth gibberish, and then they would put the camera on a title card that just had what the dialogue should be, and they would film one in English and one in French and one in Spanish and one in German, and then release it all over the world. Because they needed product. They needed ideas. They needed plot lines. And Broadway, once a play was over, in those days, they didn't revive them. So once a play was over, they could bring it to Hollywood and shoot it. But it became much more important when talking pictures came in, because the earliest big deal about talking pictures were musicals. And again, in those days, they didn't revive. Like today, half of Broadway is revivals. But in those days, they didn't do that. So they could take them and put them on film. And that's where that huge relationship between Broadway and Hollywood got started.
We were looking into this in preparation for our show today, and I came across something called the Black Maria. And that was Edison's cinematographic place where he developed little pieces of film for the kinetoscope. And so it was interesting to me that the whole what got started in New Jersey.
Yes, it did.
Started in New Jersey and then moved west through Chicago to Hollywood. I guess Chicago had a bit of a film reputation for a very short time. It didn't land there or stay there, but it went from Chicago over to Hollywood. And interestingly, that one of the little trivia things that I found is that there is a continuously running movie theater in Iowa from 1897. They've been running like over 125 years continuously since 1897. You can imagine how sticky that floor is from from
finish
all
your
the candy.
Very quickly, please. Yeah. It's true. Well, what you're talking about also, and you mentioned a good name, Edison.
Yes.
Edison was a genius, but Edison loved to sue people.
Oh.
So he made it almost impossible after a while for East Coast movie makers to use film. He'd sue and sue and sue and sue. It's why they came west, to get 3,000 miles away from Edison. And in those days, you know, it wasn't air traffic back and forth from the two coasts. So you were 4 days away, by the best way to get there, by train, just so they could get their products made without being interfered with. And the other thing was the weather, because in those days, films were shot outdoors. There was no ceiling. I'm gesturing with my hands on radio. I should know better than that. But there was no top to the little sets they had. They'd have five or six or seven of them side by side by side. You couldn't hear anything. So they could just film and film and film and film. Well, the wonderful sunshine of Southern California, it meant they had three or four times as many shooting days a year being on the West Coast. That's why movies landed on the West Coast, away from Edison and the sunshine and the ability to put out more product.
Well, let's bring it up another 30, 40, 50 years from the beginning. Movies that came from plays. I've got so many here. I have so many dozens. What comes to mind from you, from your time when you were in New York? What do you remember started out as a play and ended up as a movie?
Oh, good heavens. Well, I'll go back to my childhood. A lot of the big musicals of the 1950s and 60s and early 70s ended up being films. Fiddler on the Roof, Funny Girl, Hello, Dolly. And that's just in 1 year. Man of La Mancha, a film version of a Broadway show almost always happened if the stars of the Broadway show were big names, if it did big box office, and they could buy the rights to the play or the musical reasonably. And then you have to understand that by the time you're talking about mid-century 20th century, they weren't doing accurate films of plays and musicals. These things were being rewritten for stars. The plays would sometimes change their plot if they were a little too adult, because Broadway has always been open to adult themes and adult talking. But for Hollywood, they had to sanitize it completely. You couldn't say hell or damn until the 60s. So these films and musicals, rather than being a wonderful film representation of the big hit on Broadway, became greatly changed, somewhat changed, vastly changed. And in some cases, they kept the title and maybe one or two of the songs, and everything else was a brand new product. So your topic is successful Broadway to Hollywood. I bet everybody here listening, if you were told of a Broadway show that went to Hollywood, I think half of you would love that film and the other half of you would hate it, because they're not great representations of what was on the stage. But in some cases, I'll use Cabaret as an example, the film is actually better than the Broadway play was. The story is better. The songs are better. So each film, each Broadway to film thing is different. There's no great big umbrella we can say that, well, they were all this or they were all that. No, every single one of those 100 you found, there's a different story. And some of them were wonderful and some of them were terrible.
Jeffrey, I want to step back just a bit, because this notion of language, what was acceptable, what was not. Tell us about it. I realize I'm taking a little byway here, but when Clark Gable in Gone with the Wind,
I was thinking that,
says, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Were there gasps in the audience?
There were gasps by the censors. They put it in, quite frankly, because they wanted to give the censors something to cut out. They would do that a lot. They would purposely film a moment, a scene, a line that they knew would be objectionable to the censors, so that they wouldn't take out something else that would be more important to the film. But in this case, because it is so representative of the character, because there's this huge film that goes on for hours, and this is the button for the film, even the censors said, yes, that's what would happen. So they let it happen, and everyone was surprised.
I'll bet. I was surprised the first time I heard it. You know, you're talking about censors, and what occurs to me is that if you are going to a Broadway play and it has adult themes or adult language, you are prepared for that, and it may not have the same censorship as something which is mass produced for a mass audience. Because I'm wondering why one is censored and the other is not. Were there censors on the Broadway plays?
Not usually. Broadway plays and musicals were self-censored, meaning the original authors of the play or the lyricist, the director, the producer, and sometimes the leading people would discuss, hey, are we pushing this too far, or do we need more of this? So there weren't outside censors coming in and saying you can't do that. The only one I can think of is some of Mae West's plays, because they were so blatantly sexual. She was a brilliant writer and feared not saying naughty things or talking about sex acts or sex workers, or Mae got arrested. Actually, they had to close the show down. Other than that, Nobody wants to have a flop, and nobody wants to have a show that nobody wants to come to see. So just for the part of keeping a show alive, the people working on the show censored. Where in Hollywood, because the very conservative part of our country felt that films all by themselves were evil. Just the idea of having film was evil. So they were fighting with that kind of thought. And then, and I'm having a senior moment here. There was a body of people who were Catholic who would, with a microscope, look at these films. And if there was anything that was objectionable to Catholics in it, they would broadcast it on the radio. It would be in newspapers. It would be in Catholic things that Catholic folks subscribed to. And it's not that they were talking for all Catholics. They were just being on the side of being very, very conservative. So there's been from day one.
Pardon me for interrupting, Jeffrey. I think perhaps you're referring to the Legion of Decency.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Yes, I recall there as a parochial school kid. There we had a newspaper called The Tidings there, and there were films that were condemned.
Yes.
Now, whether this was straight from the Vatican or the Legion of Decency, I don't exactly recall, but you could find out which movies you were not supposed to go see. And if my memory serves, I believe one of them was The Pawnbroker with the great Rod Steiger. And I have seen The Pawnbroker. I don't think I'm going to hell. I don't think I have to go to confession accordingly. Nothing like that. The Pawnbroker is a brilliantly poignant. It's a brilliant, painful, and poignant movie. That's what I was trying to get out. And I don't want to give anything away, but if you haven't seen Rod Steiger in The Pawnbroker, watch that movie. It will make your heart ache, and it will open your eyes to a worldview that is all too real, and that, in my opinion, is a film that needs to be seen. It is a necessary movie.
Was that a play first?
I don't know. Let's ask Jeffrey. Was that a play, or was it made?
It was made for film.
Made for film.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, let's take a better example of something that was on Broadway. Huge, I mean, magnificent opus hit, and what they did to it in Hollywood. I mean, who could find fault with the Cole Porter musical Anything Goes? You know, you had Ethel Merman as one of the stars. You had other Broadway people being other stars. This magnificent array of songs that Cole Porter wrote, and yet when they took it to Hollywood, they took out the song Anything Goes. Because in olden days, you know, now anything goes. No. They couldn't allow that in a film. Blow, Gabriel, blow. We're talking about Gabriel, the angel, blowing his horn. That couldn't be in the show because someone somewhere is going to hear the word blow and think something sexual. Parts of the plot where Ethel Merman's character has obviously been sleeping with somebody and she's fallen in love with him and feels rejected by him. Well, couldn't have that. There's a crook who's pretending to be a minister. That all got cleaned up. The only thing they left in that they should have taken out was that this phony minister had, forgive this terrible word, but they use it in the film, coolies, Asian people who worked like slaves in this country, the early parts of the 20th century, more than 100 years ago. That they kept in. But the songs, the very, very witty book was completely rewritten. And they took out the Cole Porter songs and put in other songs that were pleasant. But the show stopped being the Anything Goes you saw on Broadway. And you ask yourself now, looking backwards, why? You know, Irving Berlin lyrics. We're having it. She started the heat wave by letting her seat wave, is this lyric, not in the films, by having her feet wave, which makes absolutely no sense at all.
But this was what was happening.
This was what was happening to anything of an adult nature, and I'm talking about the late 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, it really, really the very first musical that they allowed most of the stuff in was West Side Story, that my beloved George Chakiris won an Oscar for. But that has been the problem with New York to Broadway, or Broadway to Hollywood, is that they had to change these things so much to be acceptable that sometimes it barely resembled its parent Broadway show.
I wrote down West Side Story for another reason too, and that was the popularity was just outstanding. And it's also been called America's opera, a story. I know it's based on Romeo and Juliet, but I love the music from West Side Story. Leonard Bernstein did such a phenomenal job with that.
Well, and let's not forget Stephen Sondheim's lyrics. So that's quite a team we're talking about there.
Yeah. And the other one I wrote down was Chicago, the play that became a outstanding movie.
Well, that's one of those things where it was a play without music that was then done early in talking films, repeated again later in talking films. Then they decided to make a musical out of it, and that went on Broadway in the early 1970s. And then that, because that one is so adult in nature, they had to wait a while to make sure they could do the show properly. And it's been redone on Broadway since the first. So Chicago is a story, and it's a story about murder and sex. What a great musical to bring your children to, murder and sex. but it's brilliant. And Kandra Ebb's music is brilliant. And Chita Rivera and Gwen Verdon were brilliant with it on Broadway. I saw it not too long after it opened. And the film that was made is excellent. It doesn't deviate. It doesn't. The only thing they took out of the film, and I've never understood why, is there's a scene in Chicago. And it's a very almost a fantasy scene, where he's making his case why these women shouldn't be murdered. And there is a lady of the press, understandable, who has this little song. Well, in the Broadway version, you eventually find out that the press is so phony that the understandable lady takes off her wig and is a drag queen. And for some reason, that little twist got left out of the film. Maybe they thought that was hot stuff in the early 1970s and wouldn't play anymore, or was offensive to gay folks. I don't know. I don't know why they took that out. But Chicago really, really, really is a wonderful representation of Chicago, the Broadway musical. Even some of the big, big hits that were film musicals based on Broadway, Oklahoma and the King and I, some of them were very close to being like the Broadway show, and some of them, South Pacific, the score is tremendous. The plot doesn't come through in the film. It was overproduced. It was too big. You lost the purpose of why these songs made such sense and grabbed your heart so much. The original movie of Gypsy is terrible, because they cut out all the sex and all the innuendos. I mean, we're talking about a film about strippers, basically, towards the end. And they cleaned it up so much that it had no taste anymore. So that happens. To me, the best film versions of Broadway shows and musicals are the ones that stick pretty much to the original intent, the original dialogue, the original songs. Yeah, you can open it up, so to speak, where if you're talking about there's a bright golden haze in the meadow, you can be in a real meadow. You can do that. But if you change the plot and change the lyrics, I have very little taste for that. It bothers me.
You know, I can understand that. And it would probably bother me, too, if I had seen a lot of New York plays the way you have. The only thing that I consider that could be difficult is on stage, you only have the one stage and you create the different scenes on the one stage. Whereas when you go to movies, as you just said, you can take it outside. I mean, you can show the ocean or a mountain or something else that you can't do on stage as easily. You're asking people to, you know, suspend their belief that that painting in the background is an actual mountain, whereas you film it. I mean, I'm thinking of something like The Sound of Music. I mean, how wonderful, grand, you know, that she's on the hills. The hills are alive with The Sound of Music. You can't do that on a stage the way you can in a movie.
No, and I loved the film, The Sound of Music.
And I do too.
And I've told Julie so. But, you know, the song opens with the song The Sound of Music. They cut out the opening verse that Mary Martin sang to set it up. They took out a few of the songs that were on Broadway. Oscar Hammerstein had passed away before the film was made. Richard Rodgers took it upon himself to write new songs, music, and lyrics.
Mm.
And it's not that they were bad songs. It's just that you're losing what was on Broadway. And I know I'm being perhaps a stickler here or an old fashioned kind of guy. You can point to Funny Girl, where half of the score isn't there anymore. But at least Barbra Streisand is singing songs that Fanny Brice actually sang. Mm. So that's what they did. They dumped some of the stuff out so that Miss Streisand could sing some of the things Fanny actually did sing. But some of the songs they cut were wonderful. And it's a shame that there wasn't a film version. For those of you who have seen Funny Girl, it ends with Barbara as Fanny Brice singing My Man, which was a hit for Barbra Streisand. But the song in the show, Music That Makes Me Dance, is a wonderful song. And now nobody knows it unless you know the original Broadway production. Hello, Dolly with Miss Streisand. The whole first song is a new song. I Put My Hand In from the original show isn't there. It's replaced by something that Jerry Herman wrote new. There's a song also in Dolly, Love Is Only Love, that Mr. Herman had written for Mame. And it was cut out of the show on the road before it got to Broadway, but they decided to stick it into Hello, Dolly. You know, meanwhile, there's two extra songs in Hello, Dolly that Ethel Merman did that never got into the film. So it's one of those things. Do we want the best possible film? Do we want the best possible representation of the Broadway show? Do we want some combination of both? And it really depends on who the producers are. I'm talking about from the film. Who's the producer? What was the company back when they had studios that actually produced their own products? Which studio was it? And as I've said earlier in our broadcast today, sometimes the films ended up being better than the Broadway shows. And sometimes you'd watch them and go, tisk, 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 too bad what they did.
We are talking with Jeffrey Mark, the walking encyclopedia of show business history. And you can believe it. We're talking about from Broadway to Hollywood, successful transitions from the stage to the silver screen, and maybe once in a while the other way around. Lots more to talk about on the other side of a short break. We are Manson Mitchell, and we're mighty glad you tuned in today. We will be right back.
Hi, everybody. This is Anson Williams from Happy Days, and I'm so excited to tell you about American Road. It is the best car travel magazine in the world. They have the most fantastic adventures detailed in each magazine with all your itinerary. We could just jump in the car with your family and have the most fabulous adventures you've ever had in your life. Please, get a copy of American Road and start your own adventure.
Staying connected with Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell is easy. Just go to mansonmitchell.com for the latest info on topics and guests. Friend Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell on their Facebook pages and like the Manson Mitchell Show page at facebook.com/mansonmitchell. If you're on Twitter, share a follow with Gary and Suzanne at Mance Mitchell. Join Gary and Suzanne Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. for an unusual show that covers everything from personal growth to the paranormal.
Here's an amazing act. Here's a tremendous act. Here's a startling act. The amazing, the thrilling, the greatest, spectacular, incredible, exciting, wonderful, world fame, most unusual, novelty act.
The home of the A-Team of Alternative Talk is manceandmitchell.com. Heard right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM or streaming live from your computer anywhere.
Terry Loving wants to help you with your online marketing challenges right now. She has several courses she is giving away to help you get your business working for you online. Yes, giving away. WordPress websites are her specialty, yet her technical skills go way beyond that. Check out her blog at terryloving.com or email her directly at terry@terryloving.com. That's terry@terryloving.com.
On Friday, Manson Mitchell welcomed Jeffrey Mark, the walking encyclopedia of Hollywood, with his revelations of how smash hits on Broadway were successfully recreated for the silver screen.
On Saturday, Nicole Strickland, Marie D. Jones, and Denise Agnew discuss Women on the Fringe, their book about the challenges that women face in the field of paranormal research.
Bringing you mastery and mystery since 2007.
We are Manson Mitchell, Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 on Alternative Talk AM 1150.
Be sure to support the sponsors of your favorite shows on Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back to Manson Mitchell and our guest this hour, Jeffrey Mark. We are talking about From Broadway to Hollywood, From Stage to Film. Jeffrey, if people would like to catch you, I mentioned in the opening that you have a new podcast. I want to make sure our listeners know how they can listen to your podcast and connect with you online, social media, anything else that you would like to tell our listeners.
Well, that'll take up the next half hour, but I'll make it brief. I have a show, Jeffrey Mark Plays Ella, where every week we play Ella's music, Ella Fitzgerald, of course, and I tell you insider stories about that. That's heard on radio stations around the country, but it's also available as a podcast on every major platform there is. Then I have a new show called Ask Jeffrey Mark. From 1880 to 1980, what have you always wanted to know about show business but didn't know who to ask? Ask Jeffrey Mark. And it's live every Thursday on YouTube Live and Facebook Live from 3 to 3:30 Pacific time, 6 to 6:30 on the East Coast. And we'd love to have you guys come on that and ask me questions. I'm also part of a show called Perfectly Frank in San Francisco, where every week for about 5 minutes, I talk about Ella and Frank together as friends, as co-workers, and how each one influenced the other. And I'm with these lovely people as often as they'll have me on because I love it.
And I just want to throw in there, the spelling of your first name is, you are a Jeffrey, G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y. If you want to find Jeffrey Mark, G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y, Mark, find Jeffrey Mark, listen to his podcasts. He is the encyclopedia of show business history and lots of fun to talk with and get information from. I already learned plenty talking with you in the first half hour.
I'm glad to hear that.
Jeffrey, I believe this qualifies as trivia. If it isn't, I don't know what is, but I've always wanted to ask you, so I'm going to ask you now. I ask Jeffrey Mark, when Merv Griffin used to take the stage when he had his television show, and I believe this was at least the first iteration of his show, didn't he do a couple of different ones?
Like yes, through the years.
But through the years. During the first iteration, he would take the stage and he would somewhat offhandedly say, "Hello, Mrs. Miller." And I've always wondered, who was Mrs. Miller?
There were actually two Mrs. Millers in early television. One was a lady who came to the early Tonight shows that Steve Allen did. And she was a great straight man for comedy. And she also fancied herself to be a singer. And people would have her on their television shows and have her sing kind of badly, but allow her to do that. But the Mrs. Miller you're talking about, there was a wonderful lady who lived in Philadelphia, who I believe was a worker in a factory. But she loved television. And every day she would come in by train from Philadelphia to New York and get free tickets to whatever she could get free tickets to, back when there were lots of television shows coming from New York. And she was there so often that the hosts began to recognize who she was. And towards the end of her life, if Merv Griffin was in Hollywood, she was in Hollywood. If Merv Griffin was in Atlantic City, she was in Atlantic City. She showed up everywhere. And they would acknowledge her because the folks at home liked that. They liked seeing the hosts being kind and thoughtful to the audience. It became a running bit for them. And it wasn't just Merv. It was, she would show up at the Mike Douglas show. If Johnny was doing it, Johnny Carson was doing a show from New York, there she'd be. But she did this for decades until there weren't any more shows coming out of New York like that. And of course, until she passed away. But in very old age, there she was, her hair not combed, wearing a very old-fashioned old lady hat and an old lady dress, and her stockings rolled down and a shopping bag between her legs. And people just loved it. And Merv Griffin specifically, he's a very nice man. I'm not talking about dealing with him in business. I never dealt with him in business. But as far as how he treated people on his show and treated celebrities, when you were on the Merv Griffin show, you were treated splendidly. Johnny Carson never interacted with his guests. Merv would even like, hey, don't sing that, sing this. Hey, let's get your hair done, lady, whoever the lady was. Hey, we got a better dress than that. He really went out of his way to represent and present people on his show. So glad that you remember Mrs. I'm sure wherever she is, she's happy you remember her. And that's the story.
Thank you, Jeffrey Mark. See what I mean, folks? Walking encyclopedia.
Back to stage to film. I found over 20 plays by one person that were made into films. And I don't know if anybody else was that prolific in going from stage to film, but I was, and this is mostly 60s, 70s, and 80s. That's Neil Simon.
Yes.
He had just about every play he ever did become a movie.
Well, you know, success breeds success. And it just turns out, and I think pardon me, I believe the first Neil Simon that went to film from New York, oh golly, it starred Frank Sinatra.
Come Blow Your Horn.
Come Blow Your Horn. Thank you so much.
That's at the top of my list because it was Frank Sinatra, and it was the only time I saw in my list where Frank Sinatra starred in the movie.
Come Blow Your Horn had adult themes running through it. Where people are being called bums because they aren't married, middle-class citizens in the house with the picket fence and the 2.3 children. Come Blow Your Horn is about people who chose it. I don't mean gay and straight, but just chose not to live what used to be called the straight life. There's a song called, you know, Leaving the Straight Life Behind. That's kind of based on Come Blow Your Horn. But once they did that one, because in the early 60s, the movies were in trouble once again. People weren't going. It's why the movies became adult, because the movies were giving you things you could see on television. Like, why spend the 50 cents or 35 cents movies were back then? How dare you charge 50 cents for a bag of popcorn? And, you know, now going to the movies, you have to mortgage your house. But back then it was a very inexpensive thing, but people were staying home. So the movies grew up, and Neil Simon helped them to grow up. You know, you have a brilliant, brilliant play like The Odd Couple. And yes. And yeah. You get Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon.
Yes.
On Broadway, it was Art Carney who played the part.
Oh. Okay.
And a tremendous big hit.
Yes.
And Neil also wrote the books for musical. Writing the book means the plot and the dialogue as opposed to the music and the lyrics. And some of his musicals came to Hollywood. They made money. And it sounds terrible, but that's the criterion they were using. But if it made, oh, you made money for us, come back again. And we'll produce your shows. But if they don't make money, you're fired. That's how it is. And Neil Simon was prolific enough in touch enough with adult themes. You know, he's a brilliant, brilliant human being, was that I don't think any of his stuff failed Broadway to Hollywood. There were things he wrote for Broadway towards the end of his life that weren't big successes, and films were not made out of them because there you were. They weren't making money. Oh, Neil Simon, whatever happened to him? Well, nothing. Just he had a couple of flops. But yes, he probably, Neil Simon as the author of a play, Rodgers and Hammerstein had a nice run turning their musicals into films. Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, George Ira Gershwin, their music permeated film musicals, even if they weren't from an original show. They just took their songs and made a show out of it. And then more recently, the Disney people who have made
Disney, yes.
Who have made a fortune in New York City, turning their cartoon films into musicals and then those musicals back into live action musicals and back and forth. And Disney practically owns New York City now. The Broadway district, which was known for prostitution and drugs and naughtiness and all been cleaned up, sanitized for your protection. Literally, I think they own all of 42nd Street in the Broadway district now.
Wow.
It's a very different atmosphere in New York. It's why we're seeing so many revivals, because the people who knew how to make successful musicals have died. And the younger people who have come along didn't learn at their feet. And we're having mostly new musicals that are either rap musicals or hip hop musicals or rock musicals or pop musicals or musicals made about around a certain composer, pop music, or a certain performer of pop music. They aren't writing a whole lot of original music for Broadway. My buddy Mark Shaman is probably one of the few who is still doing and being very successful. Or they take something like Thoroughly Modern Millie and they turn that into a Broadway musical. But Disney has made really, really, really a fortune doing this.
The note that I made about Disney is that they did not start in New York. They started in the other direction in California, and they went west to east, where hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Broadway plays then became movies. Disney, as far as I can tell, was cartoon movies first and then went to Broadway. So they went in the other direction.
Disney, the Disney studios, going back to when Walt Disney was alive, have always been innovators, always followed the dollar sign. Those people always knew where the money was and where it could be made. And they made some brilliant thing. Oh, Mary Poppins is Disney that started in California and went to Broadway.
Yep.
But they always knew how to make a buck. And I'm saying this as someone who's worked for Disney, and I hosted on the cable radio network the Disney 75th anniversary of the studio being made. And that day, if I may take 1 second for pardonable pride, I was the only press there that Michael Eisner spoke to. He was refusing all interviews except with me.
Congratulations.
It's like, yay, good for me. So Disney, you know, since Walt died, other people have come along. There are still members of the Disney family involved. You know, Disney owns ABC now, and it's become a show business conglomerate. But they knew how to do it, and they put their money where their mouth was, and very slowly sort of re-landscaped the Broadway section of New York to be Disney.
Yeah. And the Lion King. Yeah.
They've made a fortune out of it.
Yeah.
I keep mentioning a fortune because when I say fortune, I mean hundreds of millions, if not billions, through the years.
Right.
Out of taking their product and putting it on Broadway and then reflexively going back and then making a movie out of the Broadway thing that was made out of a cartoon that became back and forth and back and forth. We were talking during one of the commercial breaks about Hello, Dolly. Hello, Dolly started out as a play called The Merchant of Yonkers, which I'm told, by the way, was based on my great-grandfather, who owned a hay and feed grain store, not in Yonkers, but in Bridgeport, Connecticut, but had a very similar personality. And that play didn't go as well as they wanted to, so it was rewritten as The Matchmaker. And Ruth Gordon started it on Broadway. Mm. And then The Matchmaker was made into a film, and Shirley Booth started on the film. And then that film was made into a Broadway show that starred my friend Carol Channing and my friend Carol Cook in Australia, and people I've come to love and know, Ethel Merman and Mary Martin on Broadway. And then a film with Barbara Streisand in it. So that's one that's bounced back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. That is the poster boy of what your show is about today. That shows that really had this reflexive relationship with Broadway and Hollywood.
Coast to coast, you know.
Yes, ma'am.
East coast, west coast. Yeah, interesting.
I would like to know, Jeffrey Mark, what you think, what you feel, and what you have to say about a phenomenon that I'm not sure it's even fair to call it a cult phenomenon anymore, because I think it's gotten bigger than that. It's become transcendent, if you will. And I'm talking about the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which I saw as a picture show back in the 1970s. And I'll tell you, my mind is still blown. It seems like one of those things that somebody undertook because they were willing to take a chance.
Rocky Horror was lightning in a bottle. In that it was on the London West End stage, and it came to America and got on Broadway eventually. And the people had the presence of mind to make it into a film. They kept, I believe, almost all of the original music, I believe. And they kept Tim Curry, who's a friend. In fact, Tim Curry is the man, when I first began to love Ella Fitzgerald, who showed me, you need to buy this and this and this and this. It was Tim who got me started on Ella. So I, all the way back there, it's like, thank you, Tim. And then they got really well cast with people who weren't in the musical on the stage necessarily. And the phenomenon of having it in New York City shown at midnight in Greenwich Village. And it became this thing. It became, if you lived in New York City and you went out on a Saturday night, you could do whatever you wanted. And then at midnight, go see this thing in Greenwich Village. And people started showing up in costumes and with props from the show and mouthing along dialogue and music. And there's a scene where she opens an umbrella and half the audience opens up umbrellas with her. It's you can't plan that. This is just something that was a phenomenon. Like I said, lightning in a bottle. And the people in it were enormously talented. And Tim, it's funny, about, I don't know, year and a half ago, I had dinner with Tim. Tim, unfortunately, has been ill. Tim had a stroke. So he's in a wheelchair. He's got this gorgeous Latino attendant who goes everywhere with him. He's still drinking. He's still smoking. He's still funny. He's like, he's not letting the stroke keep him from having fun. And that feeling of having fun permeates that film. It's so joyful to watch. Yeah, and at home you can enjoy it too. Don't get me wrong. But being in a theater with other fans, that is an enormous phenomenon. That is your poster boy for a success story where something did well on Broadway, but the film became iconic.
Yes, it did. And I have to admit, I was stunned at the interactive experience it became. I didn't have any of the props and I didn't have an umbrella, but plenty of people did when I went to see the film at my local theater there in California. And I just remember, okay, this is more than going to see a movie. This is a whole experience.
Yeah, there are other films now where people do that, where it has a cult following. But this one was the first, and I think the best. And I was lucky enough to be in New York and be a part of that. I didn't see the Rocky Horror Picture Show once. I probably saw it 20 times. because it was so much fun to be in the audience of this. I never got to see the musical. I think I was away in college when the musical was on Broadway, but it's a poster boy for how, the success. Not that The King and I and Oklahoma and the great shows weren't successful films, but I think maybe this is the one that's closest to taking an actual show and putting it on the screen. And you really get a sense of what the Broadway musical felt like. I know there are a lot of I know we're running short on time. There are a lot of Broadway people who wish that they would take video cameras and just video the musical in front of an audience, and you could see what that experience is and have it and keep it forever. And then if you want to make a film out of it, then it's a different experience. I delight in playing audio of Ethel Merman in Gypsy, or Mary Martin in I Do on Broadway. And we don't get that in the films.
That filming of actual Broadway plays I've seen done just a couple of times, not very often. And I want to say Les Miserables was one of them that was on television where they did was film the stage.
Right.
What else did they've done that very, very few times, but it has been done a little bit, hasn't it?
It has. The premiere version of that, when they took South Pacific to England, and Mary Martin still started it there, but with an English cast. And Rodgers and Hammerstein put three or four or five cameras in the theater, and they made a 16mm film of what the experience was of going to see South Pacific. And I have a copy of that. And okay, Mary was very, very, very nice to me. So perhaps I'm a teeny bit prejudiced. And Mitzi Gaynor is a wonderful talent, but I adore watching what South Pacific actually looked like, as opposed to the overblown, overproduced, too much thought about the camera and not enough thought about the characters and the songs of the film version.
Yeah.
And while we have a couple of minutes, let me ask you about the producers.
There is a good example, maybe the best, because it's the same creative team. The Producers was a film made in the late 60s by Mel Brooks, starring Zero Mostel, and a lot of wonderful, wonderful character actors. And I think it was Gene's film debut.
And oh, yeah, it could be.
I believe it was.
Yeah.
That's what made him a star. Mm-hmm. And, you know, years went by, and Mel had the idea, because Mel is a very, very talented songwriter and lyricist, to make it into a musical. And as popular as the film was, I still think it's the best thing Mel ever did. The musical version was an enormous hit in New York, and then another movie version of the same plot based on the Broadway musical version of it. So again, back and forth and back again. And I know Mel wanted to make more musical versions. There was a musical version of Young Frankenstein, but it didn't really go. But that's a great example of someone taking a film and musicalizing it, and it being an even bigger hit than it was as a straight play, or a straight movie, I should say.
Well, what a fun hour we had today. And Gary and I knew it was going to be that. We were really looking forward to talking with you, and appreciate your giving us an hour today to have this much fun on the radio.
I'll come on as often as you will invite me.
All right.
We will gladly hold you to that, sir. Jeffrey Mark, we'll come up with another topic, and Jeffrey Mark will be ready. Guaranteed.
Have a great night, everyone who's listening. A great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Same to you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in. We hope this is the start of your great weekend.